we don't care, let anybody drive if you want to, drunk or sober. You know, I know that's pretty far out, but is there a rule of law that would bring a case like, that would be conduct under the, as Paige Keaton says, is that accident within the risk that made the conduct negligent? Now, wouldn't that be a risk under the conduct, the hypothetical I'm giving?
Yes, but that is not the negligence that was found here. While counsel has been busy talking about the permission and the scope of the permission and the failure to restrict it, there is no finding of negligence in giving Pavelka permission, which would include his being entitled to let other people drive. The only finding is of negligent in entrusting the vehicle to Pavelka based upon his poor driving record. If they had taken that approach in the trial of the case and alleged that and got a finding of negligence in failing to tell Pavelka, don't let a drunk driver drive this vehicle, although I don't think that's a very likely finding, then we'd have a different question. But there is no such finding here. The dependence was entirely on entrusting it to this man with speeding, who had speeding tickets. In addition to talking about permission, counsel keeps talking about dangerous instrumentality. But there's nothing wrong with the car. The only thing that could make this instrumentality dangerous here was that Pavelka was supposedly an incompetent driver likely to speed. But that did not cause this accident. His propensity for speed had nothing to do with his turning the vehicle over to Schroeder. Now, as I said, the real damages we're talking about here are the exemplary damages, because the judgment was joint in several as to the actual damages. And as I say, that is out of the picture, because the payment on behalf of Pavelka, of course, removes that from the judgment against Esperanza. And we see there was also, in addition to the proximate cause issue, no evidence of probative force of grossly negligent entrustment here. As we said, there was no evidence that there was any knowledge that Pavelka ever drank, much less getting intoxicated. There was no evidence that he'd ever had a single accident. The only evidence was of these speeding tickets, and those were over a total period in excess of 5 years. So a man whose job has him out driving on the road, one ticket every 6 months is not unimaginable. And again, to say that Esperanza was not negligent, or was negligent in not learning more fully of his driving record, while it might suffice for ordinary negligence, does not suffice for gross negligence, because should have known does not amount to conscious negligence.
Mr. Brown, I'm a little bit confused now about where we are on this. Y'all have, the insurance carrier has paid off on the basis of the damages on ordinary negligence. Is that what you're telling me?
Paid off for Pavelka. Pavelka was, of course, as an employee covered.
Paid off for Pavelka.
And since there was a joint and several judgment as to that part, in effect, that's...
Well, do we have it? I can see how we would have gross negligent entrustment in front of us. But do we have an issue here on negligent entrustment, if that part of the case has been settled or paid off.
Except to the extent that you can't have gross, the negligence can't be gross if there is no negligence. Unless there was negligence.
I don't know what kind of procedural posture we're in.
But as to, I think it's even clearer there was no evidence of gross negligence because certainly the knowledge of the one speeding ticket that the witness mother said he was told about would not make it grossly negligent to allow Pavelka to drive the truck. And it must be remembered that we don't know what the facts were behind these tickets. They may have been for driving 20 miles an hour in a 15 mile an hour zone, which would not indicate that Pavelka was habitually reckless. The most important case, since Burke Royalty against Walls, is the opinion of this court in Williams against Steves Industries. And it's particularly important here because it is not only a gross negligence case, but it's a negligent entrustment case. So that it involves both of these matters, and it indicates that negligent entrustment to an incompetent driver, the element of proximate cause can be met only by the incompetence of that driver. It may be found out negligent, causing the accident. But it's also important with respect to gross negligence, because the opinion there by Justice Campbell notes that he must prove that the defendant had actual subjective knowledge that his conduct was creating an extreme degree of risk, or at least that the circumstances were such that a reasonable person would have realized that conduct here, turning over the truck to Pavelka, created an extreme degree of risk to the safety of others. The mere possibility that Pavelka, like anyone else, might become intoxicated and might entrust driving to someone else who was and who would cause an accident wouldn't create a conscious realization of an extreme danger that was going to occur when they never had any knowledge of anything like that ever having occurred before. And when there was no more possibility of that with Pavelka than as to any other employee, having speeding tickets does not indicate that you're going to turn over the car to a drunk driver or that you're going to get drunk yourself.
Was there any issue submitted on failure to get his driving record before the employee?
No, sir. The only issue is the negligent entrustment issue. The only evidence is with respect to the
But they did discover his driving record.
Not all. They didn't discover that long list. They discovered he was having a problem with his license, but he had a license. It was not revoked. And even when he had the problem, he was given probation and his license was not revoked. And of course, as Bronson did know, that he still had his driver's license. There, again, as in Williams against Steves, this court said that wherever gross negligence has been upheld, the evidence has supported the finding that the defendant had decided to ignore the rights of others even in the light of probable and threatened injury to them, the kind that occurred. And certainly Esperanza here never made any decision to ignore the possibility that Schroeder was going to drive, take over the driving while he was drunk if it hurts him, because they'd never heard of stroke and had no reason to anticipate any of this. As the opinion further says, the past Texas cases have, in specifically this kind of case, have required evidence that the driver was in fact incompetent or habitually reckless. And I'm not sure even this record establishes that if the entire record were known, and that the owner knew or should have known that the driver was incompetent or reckless. And there has been evidence beyond just showing that he perhaps was not the best driver in the world to show that he was blatantly incompetent or reckless. And certainly there was no showing of that sort here. I think it's significant that no cases were found, and my plaintiff, and I'm sure they searched very diligently, where recovery has been allowed in this kind of a double negligent entrustment kind of case. They cited one Oregon opinion, Conway against Bressler, but all that case did was hold that the fellow in the position of Pavelka could be held liable. There, Bressler's uncle owned the vehicle and entrusted it to Bressler, who in turn entrusted it to Wilt. Bressler and Wilt then being out drinking together and both being intoxicated. But they did not hold that the uncle, who originally entrusted it to Bressler, was liable. So that is of no consolation to claims here.
Does that pretty well? I'm not trying to rush you, but the court's got a little bit of a time problem. Can you kind of wrap up? I think your light's going to come on.
The other case they mentioned here, Sturdivant against Patrick, was a defective brake case, not a negligent entrustment to an incompetent driver. The one other thing involved is that in any case, this court should not reinstate the trial court judgment because there are insufficient evidence and excessive punitive damage points which the Court of Appeals did not pass on and that were clearly raised and that would have to be passed on if it were wrong. Issues.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grant.
May it please the court, Mr. Kaiser will close for petition.
If we agree with you, what are you asking us to do?
Well, Mr. Brandon is right. I'm requesting the court remand it back to the Court of Appeals to determine the sufficiency of evidence upon that were not passed upon by the court. And those deal with sufficiency evidence of gross negligence and the excessiveness of the so we may be back up there again in the event they're successful here and the court failed to utilize the correct standard of reviewing these as your findings that we continue to do in this case, essentially ignored the findings. There have been some terminology problems perhaps here. They do not disregard any findings of that term is known in legal terminology. They ignore the findings, in our opinion, in order to reach their judgment. I would like to take a few minutes, if I could, to respond to Esperanza's positions that they developed in their findings and to further develop some of the ideas that Mr. Fontaine put before the court. Our basic overall position, though, is that we pled our case. We requested appropriate issues in our case. We have jury findings on each of those issues, an unanimous jury, and the record supports the evidence. And in that situation, we think we're entitled to recover unless there's something very, very wrong, which we don't think that there is.
Mr. Brand says there is no case that allows recovery in a double negligent entrustment situation. Is that correct?
That That is correct because of the evidentiary status of each one of those cases where it has been entered. Now, the Hansen versus Green, and then I'll read from this court, I believe, I'm sorry, head of writ review, the opinion specifically says, there is no evidence in the record that appellee, the owner of the car, at any time prior to the accident, had any knowledge or notice that anyone other than his daughter Nancy would drive his automobile on the occasion in question. And that's the real distinguishing factor. In fact, this court is never going to see, I don't think, another double entrustment case with this kind of evidence. All they have to do is have a basically reasonable vehicle policy. And there will not be any double entrustment cases. All they have to do is say, use it only for your business, and then you bring it back. That's what they do now. Or they could say, we're going to let you use it for your personal business, but if you can't go out drinking in bars, and there's a specific reference to that in the record about their anticipation that a developer would go to a bar, and that's on page 535 of the record. So what they could have said, if you're going to go out and drink, you know, don't use our truck. And in no event ever let anybody else use our truck. That's all they have to say, and they eliminate every double entrustment possible. All they have to do is say, you don't have permission to give it to somebody else. And that's what Hansen versus Green said. Mr. Hansen's oldest daughter said, don't you give it to anybody else. That's in the opinion. And I think all the young ladies here in the audience, if they learned anything today, they know they're not supposed to turn over their dad's car and let other people use it or drive while they're drunk.
Not even when you're drunk. I thought we were all taught, you're drunk, don't drive, give it to somebody else.
Well, that's a very interesting position because in the trial court, Esperanza was very proud of their policy to their employees and to the jury. They're arguing, our policy is so good, it's a very reasonable policy because if our employee gets drunk, you know, that's a problem. But if he gets drunk, our policy is so good that he's not supposed to drive, he's supposed to give it to somebody else. But now, they don't want to even talk about their permission that they granted to get a flip-flop on us between here and trial court.
Let me ask you on that. I know what's on the poster. Did you ever ask the question of the vice president, straightforward, did you give permission to self-service, to let others drive this truck?
Yes, sir. I believe that's indicated here.
Well, let me see which one you claim says that.
Yes.
As distinguished from saying, if he was drunk, did you give him permission to get somebody else to drive it to take him home or something? Some hypothetical. I mean, was it just a straight out general question? Did you give this man permission to give this truck, let other people drive this truck?
Not just a general question on that basis, because we were trying, of course, to adapt his permission to our facts of our case. And their position was he was too sick. Our position was he was too drunk, like the police officer testified. And so we wanted to ask the question, you know, even in the worst case scenario, if the man's too drunk, then we have permission to let Schroeder drive it. And the question, the answer is, Schroeder was given, Schroeder, not developer, Schroeder, the double entrusted, Schroeder was given a truck to drive on that day with the full permission of Esperanza. He said, well, the person that was responsible for the truck gave him that permission. But that was with the company's permission to do so. Yes, sir. So that's the issue, or the evidence, rather, that we say is at least some evidence. The Court of Appeals has held that as a matter of law, we can't prove our case. And in doing so, they haven't analyzed the record. They haven't looked at the jury findings we've got. They said, you just can't prove it. We're not going to look at it. And we requested the court review that type of review of the jury findings. Now, the only finding in fact that were contested by Esperanza, and this is very important, and Justice Garland, you'll be interested in the exact procedural posture of the case. The only finding that was contested is that Esperanza's negligence was proximate cause. They conceded their negligence. They have never filed an appeal. appeal, asserting as point of error that they were not negligent. They contest that their policy was broken, and they contest the amount that was in for damages. Now let's look at what they do not contest. They do not contest that Esperon was negligent in the trucking of his vehicle. Never have, and they accept that as binding on appeal. They have never contested the jury finding that their employee was grossly negligent. They've never contested the evidence to support their finding. They've never contested the actual damages, yet they get up here, you know, Esperon's position today is that the actuals were outlandish. If they're so outlandish, why didn't they appeal those jurors? They didn't come up here. It's not a minor injury. We didn't somehow bootstrap our way into this situation. We didn't create the facts. We didn't create this company's policy. Putting these people on the road with this kind of condition, doing this kind of thing. We didn't create the facts. We're just presenting them to the court. Now, if we want to pigeonhole...
Well, did they contest whether Schroeder was grossly negligent?
No, they contested none of the other companies.
They're only contesting that they are not grossly negligent.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay. Exactly. Okay. And all the other findings are final, binding, and acceptable on appeal. Now, if we want to pigeonhole this case and say that it is a negligent trusting case and that somehow makes it different from your basic negligence plus proximate cause and liability, let's look at what the traditional negligent entrustment case is, and let's compare that with what findings we have which are conclusive on appeal. The basic negligent entrustment case, you have the negligence of the owner, you have the negligence of the entrustee, and you have the proximate cause flowing from the entrustee to the occurrence. So those are the findings that we have in this case, which are binding on people. In a traditional case, Esperon admits that it was negligent, that its employee was grossly negligent, and that its employee negligent was a proximate cause. They have contested none of those findings. And that puts it right into the shelf with a basic traditional negligent entrustment case that we win as a matter of law. The Court of Appeal has turned their jury findings on their head. Our position is you need to turn right back on the other side. We've established conclusively that the traditional elements of the negative equipment case. I got a lot of things to cover and have to skip. What I would like to do very briefly is address Judge Bill Garland's very pointed issue about what needs to be foreseeable. What is it that has to be foreseeable at all? Now, I've got a chart. That may not be large enough, but this sets forth the two elements, the traditional elements, cause and effect, foreseeability. And I'm sorry if you can't read it. The foreseeability, in this case, Henry versus Pure Distributors, and I'm cited in my brief, it's something I found. I got involved in the case very late.
We know the case.
I'm certain you do. The case sets forth what has to be foreseeable in general terms. It's one of the seminal cases out of this court. You have to have a foreseeable plaintiff, and a foreseeable plaintiff, and the foreseeable plaintiff is my terminology, what's under it is quoted out of the case. And the foreseeable plaintiff is that there's harm to one similarly situated to the plaintiff. Either that harm was foreseen as to this plaintiff or one similarly situated to him. The other is that there's a foreseeable mechanism of the injury. In other words, that the harm arose out of a damaging event or accident of the same general character that you could foresee. So, applied to this case, the foreseeable plaintiff, by grossly entrusting a vehicle to an employee with this kind of driving record, is that he's going to have a wreck. And the wreck's going to occur on the traveling public. And that's who your foreseeable plaintiff is. Your foreseeable mechanism of injury is that it's going to be a car wreck. When you entrust a vehicle to a bad driver, that's the foreseeable result.
And we don't have to proceed. The court has never required that we proceed the exact mechanism of the injury, the particular sequence of events that's going to occur. You know, all we have to do is proceed the result, and the reason that you proceed the result, or help to proceed the result, is because that's what we're trying to prevent. There's an infinite number of ways that you can reach a result, and it matters not, you know, how you reach the result under the law. It's just that the result of what we're trying to prevent, that's what has to be reasonably foreseeable, and these are the two subset rules of foreseeability. We don't have to foresee that it would have happened on Thanksgiving. We don't have to foresee that you only had 3 beers instead of 4 beers, that kind of thing. And there's one example of a case that draws that out. I've got several examples that I wish I had time to talk to the court about. But one example is a Sixth Circuit case that's cited in Prosser's phone book on court. We've got a bunch of these examples. I thought this one was pretty good. A ship owner empties the oil out of his ship tank, but he doesn't rinse out the inside to take all the oil residues out. And so the foreseeable risk there is that there's going to be a fire or an explosion. Now, that's what happens. But what causes the fire or explosion is lightning strike. And there's liability there because the result was anticipated. You're not required to proceed. You don't have to perceive how it's going to happen. But if you can reasonably perceive the results, then you're going to be responsible. In that case, this Johnson versus Cosmo 64, that second one, and it's really just for the record. It's not even reviewed or something like that in preparation for the argument. The defendant's argument, I want to make one more point before the time is out. The defendant's argument is essentially we have an intervening cause in a matter of law. And I want to point out that they never pled intervening cause. They never requested an instruction on intervening cause. And so I find it very difficult to see again as a matter of law on an intervening cause argument we have in place. The result in this case is foreseeable, given the broad grant of permission that was given to this man with this kind of record. Not required that the same type of problem, the same defect in this person in the driving record, it doesn't matter that it wasn't speeding that was involved in the wreck. And the two cases that are directly on point are the old entrustment cases by this court, Lundy versus Pierce Large, Bratton versus Butler. Those cases, the same argument was made. They say, look, Judge, this guy didn't have a driver's license, and there was no finding that his failure to have a driver's license was the cause of this wreck. And the court said, it doesn't matter. He's a competent driver. And that's what we move on to. This is what the jury was reasonably concluded.
Thank all counsel for a good presentation. We'll take a 10-minute break.
Judge, please rise.